This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Gordon Ball. He's an old friend of mine, but also the author of a book that I wanted to talk to him about called East Hill Farm, Seasons with Allen Ginsberg. And of course, we can talk about some other things too, as often these conversations range far afield. How are you, Gordon?
I'm fine, thanks, David.
Well, it's really good to talk to you. I think this may be the first time you and I have spoken in over 40 years since we knew each other in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, probably in the mid-70s.
I think the last time we saw each other was when you were introducing Jane Ann Phillips to Chapel Hill.
Wow, you have a good memory. That was 1975.
Is that right?
Yeah. I have the poster still of that reading. I think it was at the Bull's Head bookstore in 1975, probably in the spring when it was beautiful in Chapel Hill, as it usually is in the spring.
Yeah. You know, I once heard that Charles Lawton used to go to Chapel Hill in the spring and sit out on Franklin Street and weep. It was so beautiful.
Well, I have, you know, I can understand that. I went back there, I think about a year ago, and it was April. And I thought it brought back memories of physical feelings of the air and the light. I think it is a very, you know, it's got a real profound beauty to it.
Indeed.
So, but you were there after the subject of this particular book, and we're talking about this book, I think, partly because it's such an interesting period, going back to the late 60s. You were in New York, having been deported from Mexico, apparently. And
well, I was in New York City after graduating from Davidson for a year, and that's a subject I wrote about in 66 Frames. My first book, which I'll give a reading of, then to Mexico after that, and then deportation back to the States and New York. Very quickly, New York, not New York City only, but then up to the farm that Ginsberg was setting up.
Right, which was in Cherry Valley.
Just outside. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's an odd, you know, certainly an interesting idea for Allen Ginsberg, you know, a kind of known to be an urban person to decide to set up a farm, but probably not inconsistent with a lot of what was going on in that period.
He felt he had to, or he was two things. He was inspired to after taking an acid trip in Wales, which he wrote about in Wales Visitation, a long poem that the New Yorker published, except they removed at the end of the poem, next to his name, the word LSD. But he took this long acid trip and wrote a poem about it, and that contributed to his interest in getting back to the soil. Secondly, equally important, if not more, was he was helping friends with the rare event of getting money through poetry, which he was able to do by passing on most of his income to friends that didn't have much income or any from writing. And however, he was finding that in those days, in the mid '60s, it was going up their arms or to similar problematic matters, and so thought to get everybody out of the urban environment that was they were so prey to.
Right, and I think that impulse was very. I felt that was really. I mean, so much a part of Allen's personality. You know that he was without being overtly being sort of. He wanted to help people in so many different ways. But these were a lot of these were friends of his who were really not very well suited to the life of the land, as we might say.
That's true. And after we'd been there a while, he told me that he got the farm for Kerouac.
Right. And of course, by the time the farm was really developed in any form, Kerouac was dying.
Yeah, after a year and a half, he died, yeah.
Yeah. But it also, I mean, it brought Orlovsky out to this out of the city. And you talk about Herbert Hunky being there and a number of people that, and well, Corso showed up as well, although he's, as you show him, fairly problematic everywhere he went. And certainly that way at the farm, but so much of it was your role at the farm was to be the kind of linchpin of practicality, in a group that was not very practical to begin with.
Right. And nor was I very practical to begin with.
Right. Well, you had no experience in farming either.
No,
but you seem to have had a more, and I'll say this, you know, grounded approach, and maybe it's because you were younger and came from a really different place than all, you know, just both, you know, socially, culturally, but also by age, a different, you know, just a different place than all of those older beatniks, basically. But I think a lot of the story is really, so much of it is about Peter Orlovsky and his brother and his other brother and his mother, you know, and it's just, it was very interesting to me how much Orlovsky is a part of this story.
Well, indeed, yeah. Alan took a vow, you know, to be with him, to enter heaven together.
Right. But all the time that you were there, or at least most of the time you were there, also Peter was with a woman pretty much nonstop, right?
Well, Denise came up a little bit after the first year or so, somewhere in there.
So quite an amazing cast of characters throughout. And
yeah.
I was really struck a lot by the sense of how people in the farm related to people in the community. I was thinking about this because I was talking to a friend who's in Vermont and who's been in Vermont a really long time, and a sort of, you know, time that I spent there in that period was similar, that there was a you know, the kind of back to the land hippie movement was bringing a lot of people to rural areas like Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, upstate New York, Northern California, New Mexico. And they were, all of those people were coming into contact with people who had lived there all their lives. And it was, you know, there was both conflict and also over a period of time, each influencing the other culturally, socially, in many other life ways. And that struck me a lot about the stories you told about East Hill Farm in Cherry Valley.
Yeah. And of course, the whole counterculture issue, generational conflict and the Vietnam War going on.
Right. And that was a big part of the story. All of the, you know, I thought that was really interesting in that you did not ignore the larger world around. And of course, makes sense because Alan was so involved with the politics during that time. It would be difficult to ignore, but, you know, I thought it made the story much more, the memoir, more inclusive of its social and political era. So I see that in the book you mention you talked to a lot of people who were there and who whose recollections aided yours, but did you keep a diary or a journal during this time?
Oh yeah, I did. It was relatively scant, but it was enough for me to quote from time to time in the book. And I did. But I had to rely on a lot of things, from my memory to various kinds of artifacts to a few other survivors, people in town as well as people from the counterculture, if you will.
And so, what is going on at the farm now? Is it?
It's Bob Rosenthal, who was many years Alan's secretary, is there now, and and looking after the place, and in fact has built a new place to live, and the old house is the barn is gone, and the house is not livable.
And how about your Ram water supply?
Oh, that died. You know, the plumber who helped us put everything in said, "Well, this system will last 20 years," and it did.
So, do they have a well now, or is it?
Well, the well is still there, as far as I know. I mean, there was an old well, and it was still there, fed by a spring.
That sounds like an amazing place. It would be worth visiting, I think, at some point. Do you know whether people go there kind of to pay homage to Alan?
Yeah, I hear about that every now and then. Yeah. I don't know how often.
And how does your, do people talk to you? I mean, are there kind of, does your book relate to people? I mean, do people relate to the story in the book as a way of understanding Alan and his history?
Gee, that's a good question. I think the book did not get a lot of publicity, so I don't know how much it got around. I mean, I really appreciate this interview.
Well, you know, I think that people, it's hard for me to gauge, you know, I don't really, because, and I'm sure you feel this way a little bit too, when something is part of your lived experience, as poetry was for me in the 70s, I don't think of it in sort of historical terms. But of course, Alan is a historical figure at this point. You know, he's, you know, there are people who study the counterculture and the history of the 60s who didn't live through it. And so you're a primary source for them.
Yeah. And the Beat Generation, and there's a Beat Studies Association and so forth.
Right. Although, I always think of the Beat period as kind of ending before the counterculture period. You know, I know they merge, and there's no, you know, not really a scholar, so I don't have a framework for thinking about it in that way. But I, you know, as I was growing up, I think I'm a few years younger than you are, but I never felt that the Beats were part of my lived experience. I might have met, I met Alan and I met Corso. I met a few people that were Beat poets, but their experience, and I knew Michael McClure fairly well, but I never felt, I never experienced them in the Beat period that we think of as being their core era, because I was too young.
Yeah.
So I think of them as, you know, in the countercultural framework of the of the 60s, which really, you know, in your book is really about that period.
Uh-huh.
Sort of post-Beat in a way.
Uh-huh.
Do you feel like you got to know and were friendly with Hunky? It feels that way.
Oh, yeah, I liked Hunky. He was fun. I mean, he was a con man. He was a good storyteller. And he was fun to be with.
Yeah, he's, you know, it's funny. My image of him before reading this book was very different. I thought of him as really a kind of, I don't know what. I think maybe some sort of like a hobo vagrant, you know, junkie street guy. You know, I didn't have a sense of him as a human being at all. And I read some of his work, and I just, you know, he always had that image of being somewhat dark and almost a cipher. So your book really helped me. Your recollections helped me understand him as a really, you know, as a kind of sweet guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
But also a junkie. You know,
it's like, oh yeah. Oh yeah. He would do this and that as he needed to obtain his medicine.
Right. Did you keep in touch with him after you left?
I did for a while. He got a little pouty sometimes. I would come to New York and he would say, "Why didn't you call me first?" or something like that. And so I kind of shied away near the end. But he also lived a long life. It wasn't like that was his during his final days.
And you know, I actually don't know what he did subsequently, like throughout the 70s. And
well, he was back in New York much of the time and staying at the Chelsea part of the time, staying in on the Lower East Side with his friend Lewis Cartwright, who unfortunately was killed on the street at one point, and still being hunky, basically, streetwise, and hustling a bit to score what he needed.
And did Alan...
And Alan was helping him still.
Yeah, yes. That's what I thought, that Alan seemed, you know, there were certain people that he really did take care of.
Yes, yes.
And Hunky seemed to be one of those guys.
Yeah.
And you, after you left, you were there, I think it's about 4 years, is that right?
At the farm, three.
Three. And do you feel like that was for you a formative period in your life?
Oh, sure, but lots of periods feel that way, but yeah, sure.
Right.
I mean, I'm very grateful to have been in Alan's company for so long and to be able to still keep up with him some afterwards.
And of all the people that kind of passed through, and there were many, and all these, you know, in the 3 years that you were there, is there one who stands out for you as being the most important, you know, staying with you through the rest of your life?
Oh, I don't know. A lot of people, I mean, a lot of people were important, and some were dear to me. Barbara Rubin, who died a few years later, or seven or eight, or however many, and my friend Candy, and even Gregory in some ways. We were pals there for a while, and Peter, who was very complicated and, you know, and very endearing. I mean, there was nobody like Peter Orlovsky. He was the most glorious rooster that ever crowed, you know?
I know you really brought him to life. I thought he was, I never had a clear, I don't think I ever met him. I never had a clear, idea of him as a person, more as a writer and as the, you know, the close, figure in Alan's life, but I don't think, you know, I think this is really a pretty beautiful portrait of him.
Oh, thank you.
And and complicated also by the presence of his brother, Julius.
Yeah.
It's sort of, that reminded me of the Dustin Hoffman portrayal of the Rain Man, you know, this kind of difficult to fathom person.
Yeah.
And it felt, and did I get from this that were you saying that Julius did have some sort of psychological disorder, but that it was made much worse by the period of time he spent in an institution when it sounded like he should never have gone to a place like that?
I don't know the answer to that. I didn't know him, you know, until the farm. So I can't judge. I think Julius did have real problems, but I can't, you know, evaluate the origin of them.
Right. No, and what became of him? Did he stay at the farm?
You know, in later days, I would try to locate him, and I would end up being told when I would trace him back to one place or another, usually in Binghamton, New York, some kind of halfway house or something of the sort, or the hospital there, I would be told only family can be given this information.
Huh.
And I would ask Peter, and he would never have it straight. And I went with Peter in about 74 to visit Julius in Binghamton, took some photos then, you know, sort of a nut about taking photos and filming. But anyway, we visited him, and that was the last time I saw him, I think, about 74, 75, the time you and I were talking about, the last time we saw each other.
Right, because you went to Chapel Hill to go to graduate school.
Yeah, in 73.
Right.
Yeah. But I would frequently go up north to check back in on things.
Right. And during this time, it sounds like you were identifying and you were really acting as you were more of a filmmaker than a writer at that point. Is that true?
Well, I don't know. I made a film of the farm, a silent movie called Farm Diary. And I really began making films with sound shortly thereafter, and have and still shoot video sort of diaries today. But yeah, so I was. I mean, I've been several different things and still am.
So when you did, is it possible to view the film that you made of the farm? Is that available anywhere?
Yeah, there is a print of part one of the farm, the first year, at Filmmakers Cooperative in New York.
Ah, yes.
But it has not been yet transferred and available to DVD.
Or streaming.
There may be a DVD at the co-op. I'm not sure now. Huh. There's some work being done on it, but I'm not sure about the status.
There's so many interesting films that were made during that period that I think have never yet become widely available.
Yeah.
And, in an age of YouTube where you can see almost anything, it seems too bad, I think.
Yeah.
There was a few years ago, I found a piece of film on YouTube that really just struck me. It was somebody's kind of home movie, a film of Alan and Neil Cassidy and a few other people that I recognize but don't know very well from that period. I think Diane DePrima is in it too. And it was basically, I think, Second Avenue, somewhere around 10th Street. So it must be near where Alan's apartment was. And they were just out on the street, you know, interacting, and somebody was going in to get a soda from a store and getting in a car to go somewhere. You know, it was home movie kind of stuff. It wasn't shot as a film, but it was so interesting to see. Uh-huh. You know, you really feel like it would be really interesting to see your film, I think.
Well, there's a few minutes of it in a movie that Chuck Smith, a filmmaker, is making on Barbara Rubin now. Yeah. Called Barbara Rubin, I think Barbara Rubin and the Exploding Underground, and he uses three or so minutes of the farm diary in that. As it stands now, I'm not sure about the finality of things.
Huh. Well, that's something that would be worth seeing. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Barbara Rubin, because she's really an important character.
She was precocious, and she impressed and motivated a lot of people, and including Jonas Mekas, who I think remained in love with her his whole life through, and in whose charge she was brought from asylum because she had been a bad girl and run away, as I understand it, and so some intermediary knew Jonas and asked him to look after her, and so she took the underground film world by storm with this movie, Christmas on Earth, named after Rambo, and a lot of exquisitely done black and white orgy scenes, and that was really quite something. And then my friend Candy and I knew her in New York, and we were engaged in film projects together, and then Barbara had the idea to get a farm with Alan and ultimately to marry Alan there and raise a family. That was not something he had in mind, but he did accede to the farm plan, and Barbara did all the footwork looking at places and settled on this one. And part of the book has some of the argument between Alan and Barbara, because Alan's not quite sure it was a good idea and is worried about being a white elephant, which it was, as it turned out. It was too much for him to keep up. So there in the snow belt with no electricity and no running water the first year and a half and so forth, remotely located. But she was an inspiration to many. She brought lots of people together, including Warhol and the Velvet Underground, myself and Ginsberg, for instance. And then she left everybody and went into older forms of Judaism. And I watched her wedding celebration. Then about seven or eight years later, she was... she died in giving birth to her fifth child.
Right. But she also, I think you mentioned this, that that Dylan was at the wedding.
That's right.
And you were there as well. And but she had a connection to him also.
Oh, yeah, they knew each other. If you look at Bringing It All Back Home, that's Allen Ginsberg in a top hat without a beard and on the back cover, and Barbara Rubin massaging Dylan's shoulders or head.
Yeah, she becomes a fairly, you know, it's like a, she has this kind of metaphysical role for so many people.
Well, yeah, sort of the Maud Gonne, you know.
Yeah. But very sad that she died so young, I think.
Yeah. 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 My wife, Kathy, was always thought, oh, now, you know, I'll get to meet her someday.
Right.
Heard
right.
So much about her.
Well, I think there are other, I think of people, and of course, my memory is not so good of that era. I think, you know, you talked a lot about, you know, taking acid and all the kinds of things that were going on. That's why I often wonder how we can remember anything that happened then.
Well, I'm sort of hung on memory, I think. I mean, not that it's a ironclad thing, but it kind of things, a fair number of things seem to stay with me.
Well, I noticed in reading your book of, I guess it is a book of memories, Dark Music.
Yeah.
Some of the, you know, that was a very memory laden kind of impressionistic collection.
Yeah.
Where you have lots of detail memory. You have much more detail memory than, for instance, I do. I think about my father was really good about that. He was he always felt like he had this kind of amazing photographic memory, and he literally had memories of being of what things that happened to him when he was 3 years old. Mm. I don't have that. It's just, I think some people do and other people don't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You evidently do.
Well, I don't know how far it goes back, and I'm not like Kerouac, who said he remembered his birth, but,
Which is kind of doubtful, I think. Biologically, I don't think it's possible.
Yeah.
But I think it's not so much how far back you can remember, but more the detail of memory and being able to remember things that people said to you and not just impressionistic memory, but more the specifics. I think some people can do that. You evidently can.
Thank you. I like it. I love that book. I sometimes think of it as my favorite, Dark Music.
Yeah, no, I liked it. I liked it a lot. And it is, the darkness is meaningful in multiple ways,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yes.
I like that too. And of course, you have there's a certain, you know, because your early childhood you spent in Japan, that gives you this sense of other level of experience that is really unusual.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps frame, I think, your memories.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I think it was really fun talking about this book. We really didn't. I mean, the book is very long, and we couldn't really talk about a lot of the details in it. But I was really. I really could not stop reading it. It was very attracting. It attracted me to experience that time and place. It's one that, you know, it's not a sentimental notion of it, but more just being able to inhabit that time frame vicariously, because it is so many years ago, but also not a place that I ever actually was. So it's vicarious both in geography and in time, but I thought very rewarding to be able to go there.
Thank you.
So thanks for talking to me, Gordon. I really appreciate it. And I hope that we won't have another 45-year interruption in
Well, indeed. Maybe we'll actually see each other.
That might be really interesting.
Yeah.
So thanks again. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Gordon Ball mostly about his book, East Hill Farm, Seasons with Allen Ginsberg, but we also talked about his other book, Dark Music, and a bunch of other things. Thank you so much, Gordon.
Thank you, David.